Good evening and welcome to Transatlantic History Ramblings with Lauren and Brian. I'm Lauren from Swansea in the United Kingdom, and with me, as always, is...
It's Brian in Buffalo, New York, US of A, where it is 49 degrees in the middle of winter, Lauren. This is freaky.
I know, global warming, hey?
I don't understand it. I don't get it. All I know is that usually I'm balls deep in snow, and it's 49 degrees. How is it in Wales?
It's cold, but no snow. Lots of rain, as normal, but it is chilly.
I was going to say, doesn't it always rain in Wales?
Yeah, it does.
Always. Although, apparently, I'm not supposed to make Welsh jokes anymore.
Well, no, I'm not supposed to make jokes. That's the problem. Me making jokes was the problem.
I know, but I got a few emails from people saying that, you know, I am pretty hard on Wales.
He doesn't really mean it. He's being silly.
So, in honor of that, I decided I'd give you some jokes that are specifically for Welshies.
Okay.
All right, you ready for how does a good joke in Wales start?
Like,
hey, Lauren.
Yeah.
How does a good Welsh joke start?
I don't know.
Two sheep walk into a bar.
If you say so.
All right.
I've been doing good things for the community. Did you see on my Facebook how many bags we packed yesterday?
I did.
It's over 2,000 bags we packed.
That's a lot of bags.
Yeah, and they're all going to school children. So all the local primary schools, so those are children between the ages of 3 and 11. So every household in those schools will get a bag to share. Though I think Theo will be getting one. Though I think all the chocolate will be taken out and eaten.
So what... Yeah. What else is in the bags?
So there is Christmas there's mince pies.
Oh, that's lovely.
A Yule log. So like, I don't know if you have them in the US. There's like it's like a Swiss roll covered in chocolate.
No, then, it sounds lovely.
And then a Terry's chocolate orange.
Christmas. So basically, you're giving the kids diabetes. For Christmas.
No, they're meant to share it with their families. It's for the whole family, but we just thought we'd distribute them through the schools, through the primary schools, because it makes it easier and we also cover a wider area. So that's what we did. And there were also in our community, we're hoping to have enough bags left over to go to. There's like a I don't know quite how to describe it, and I don't know the proper name for it, but it's like a block of flats specifically for teenagers who are transitioning out of the care system. They go to live there for 18 months and they get taught how to cook for themselves, how to budget, and we usually take some bags there for them
with lots of chocolate.
Yes,
you know, chocolate's good. I like chocolate.
So, yeah, that's what we did yesterday. And on Friday, we set everything up, 8 pallets of goodies.
You know what I did yesterday?
What? Slept.
I slept till 2 in the afternoon.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I'm good at sleeping, Lauren. I'm so good at sleeping, I can do it with my eyes closed. It's true, actually.
When Corey was a baby, he used to sleep with his eyes open. Creepy child.
That's creepy. There was a girl I went to school with who slept with her eyes open, and she'd like fall asleep in class all the time with her eyes wide open, and then she'd start snoring, and it was weird.
We used
to call her a witch.
I just used to call him Creepy Baby.
Yeah, your nicknames weren't as creative as mine. So, Lauren, have you triggered anybody this week? Have you been a bully?
I'm never a bully.
That's not what I heard.
I don't quite understand that, to be quite honest with you, because I think we were both giving as good as we got.
I don't know, Lauren. It comes across that Brian is playful and sweet and adorable and wonderful, and Lauren's just a bully.
No, because you called me a sheepshagger.
And?
I don't think it's racism, but I think it's xenophobia to do that.
A little bit.
I don't quite understand how you got away with being xenophobic.
I think because you said you may shag them, but we eat them. So who's xenophobic now?
That's the only... Nobody. If you're saying I'm a sheep shagger.
Do they really? No, I gotta ask, because I make the sheep shagger jokes. But do they really have a lot of sheep and whales still? Is whales still filled with sheep and stuff, or is that just like a myth?
I didn't catch any of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said, I know I make a lot of jokes about sheep shagging and things, but I got to ask, because usually...
There are sheep,
But I mean, I think in New Zealand more for sheep. Are there a lot of sheep in Wales?
Yes.
So, I got a question then. How do Welshies find sheep in tall grass?
I don't know.
Irresistible. All right.
I just don't get it. I just don't get it. I mean, if you're going to be xenophobic, then of course, after what, you are going to get somebody just biting back and saying back off.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you right now, everyone knows I'm kidding, because there's no way in hell I think Tom Jones shagged any sheep.
Well, I think he'd beat you up.
Well, he's Tom friggin' Jones. Tom Jones ain't shagging no sheep, Lauren.
I think he'd beat you up for even suggesting that.
With his mind, he would beat me up. No one complains about the bathroom buddy. No one complains about all the Duff's promos, but they complain about you not laughing at my jokes, Lauren. And I'd like to point out that so far there's been two you didn't laugh at today.
Oh, wow.
Should I try some more?
If you feel like failing.
You know, you don't even go in with a positive attitude. It's that bully in you. All right, here's one. Here's a cute one, Lauren. Why do melons have such big weddings?
I don't know.
Because they can't elope. Cantaloupe. I know. You want more holiday-themed jokes, don't you, Lauren?
No, not really. I really would like the jokes to stop.
I think you want a holiday-themed joke, folks. What do you think? No, you think she wants a holiday-themed joke? Jokes to stop. What do you think, audience? Do you think we want a holiday-themed joke? Now the audience has spoken, Lauren.
Okay.
All right. What did the third wise man say before giving the baby Jesus his gift after the gold and frankincense had already been delivered?
I don't know.
But wait, there's myrrh. Get it like an infomercial?
I know.
Come on, that was cute. You didn't like it, huh?
No.
Lauren hates the holidays, apparently, folks. She says there's nothing funny about Christmas.
I never said that.
You did, however, say that Oscar could have been convicted of bird slaughter last week.
I did. And people love that.
Because I have gotten several messages this week from people saying they did go and watch Christmas Eve on Sesame Street for the first time. And they don't think it would hold up in court. They think it's Big Bird's own fault. But they all do agree, Lauren, Oscar said motherfucker.
Yeah, he did.
See, you'll admit it now.
I don't think I ever denied it.
Well, you didn't officially deny it, but you implicated that I believe he said that, like I'm the only one. You made an implication as though Brian is a moron. Don't say it.
You know me, I'm a bully, aren't I?
Speaking of me being a moron.
What did you do? Do you have to say an apology?
No! I wanted to point that out. My mother said, oh, you're free to talk about Dr. Down Under. The show is wonderful. And she started telling me about episodes, Lauren. I don't want to watch the show. Because you remember what I told you? Dr. Down Under ain't Australia.
You don't have to. Your mom is giving you a running commentary on it.
Oh, who's going to have to give an apology now? She's not giving a running commentary, Lauren. She just likes it.
Oh, I thought she was telling you about it.
Well, she was telling me about episodes. I don't want to.
Sorry, yeah. I thought I misunderstood.
She did say that it is nothing like, you know, I stuck a yin-yang in my hoo-hoo, which was the worst show ever. I think that one was just called Stuck, which is even bad enough.
Yeah.
But she likes this new one. You know who she hates, though?
Who?
Dr. Pimple Popper. My mother hates Dr. Pimple Popper.
Why?
I don't know, but she says horrible things about her.
Well, I just think it's a weird premise that you're going around doing that to people.
Well, she's a dermatologist.
I know, but it just seems very weird that you make money off it.
Have you ever even Google searched anything or YouTube searched anything? Like, pimple popping is like this huge fucking thing.
Yeah, I know. It's not for me.
I don't get it.
Yeah, I know, but I don't understand. You know, like, some of these people have, like, really, I understand in one way. It's like, if you sort of can say, oh, I've got something like that, maybe I need to go to the doctor. But sometimes these people are taken such advantage of, it's a bit weird.
Yeah, like when I had to go have Bilal moved from the back of my neck. Remember, Lauren? I sent you the pictures.
You did.
That was legitimate. They weren't going to put that on TV, though, were they? No, because they weren't going to squeeze it and have a bunch of shit fly out of it. It was just a snip and it was gone.
But the doctor did like that you named it.
The doctor loved that I named it. And when they called me to tell me that it was not cancerous, they referred to it by its name. Thank you.
Did they?
Yeah. Your little friend Bilal is non-cancerous, they told me.
Oh, wow. Did they ever work out what happened?
They think it was just a skin tag that got something happened to it and it inflamed and just kind of exploded.
Oh.
It was massive, though, wasn't it?
It was.
I did our listeners a favor by not putting the pictures on the website, which I wanted to, but you talked me out of it.
I don't think that was a good idea.
It was horrible, wasn't it?
It was.
And it was right on the back of my neck.
It was like, it was weird because it was like, because sometimes when skin tags swell, they lose their shape, but that one still looked like a skin tag.
It looked like a testicle. On the back of my neck.
Oh,
admit it, Lauren. I had ball neck. Neck balls.
Well, could be worse. You could have chin balls like Peter Griffin.
That's true. And it wasn't balls, actually. It was one ball, so I was like the Lance Armstrong of neck balls. Oh. I just make a Lance Armstrong having one testicle joke. Yes, I did, and I don't regret it.
I don't think anybody will mind anymore.
Hitler only had one ball, you know.
Did he?
Yeah. Hitler had one nut. I don't know why I know that. It's like one of those facts that I know that. Do you remember when the History Channel played nothing but Hitler shows and they used to joke that the H was for Hitler in History Channel?
Yeah, now they just do UFO shows.
Ancient alien shit now, yeah. But
I wonder if we'll have one where Hitler is an alien.
I'm sure. And that's how he lost one of his testicles. But there are two facts about Hitler that I know that I did not learn from any of those History Channel shows. And yet, these are well-known facts, but yet they never spoke about them on these History Channel shows. You know what those two things are, Lauren? Well, you know one of them now.
Yeah.
What's the first one, Lauren?
Then what about Hitler?
Yeah, what about him? Come on, you just don't want to say it, do you?
No, not really, because I don't know if it's true.
Hitler had one nut. Okay, one ball Hitler. We used to call him 81 nut, but... The other fact about Hitler that is true, but they never talked about this on the specials, Hitler farted a lot.
Well, yeah, because he used to do all these weird treatments.
Yeah, Hitler was like, they might as well just called him Shitler.
I think we've talked about this before, mate.
Yeah, and how immature I am that every time, like, there's a Hitler show on TV and Sarah's watching it, I always constantly do... Oh, look, there's the Fuhrer. She gets so mad at me. But it's true.
You don't see that in Indiana Jones when he goes to get his book signed by Hitler.
No.
That is one of my favorite bits when he gets the Grail Diary signed by Hitler.
That was a little wicked laugh.
It's just so funny.
But I don't want to talk about Hitler. Hitler was a bad dude. We're approaching the holidays. And next week, folks, next week's show is going to be wonderful. We're going to do our annual holiday episode. Now, it's going to be weird. It's not going to be like normal where everybody starts out, we talk. We're going to have people coming and going as the night goes on. But we've got several guests lined up that are going to be popping in at some point in the show. Some will be there for the whole show. Some will be there for part of it. Others will pop in at random. But so far we got...
No. Because the guests might listen to the show, and there is one guest in particular that we want to surprise in a very nice, positive way.
Oh, yeah. Well, she knows.
Oh, she knows.
She knows because someone posted it on Twitter, not me.
Who posted it on Twitter?
Jeremy.
Of course!
But, yep, Casey's coming back on. And the one and only Jeremy King. The great Michael Anthony Giudicessi is going to come on. Kurt Konecki might be popping in. You're going to be there, Lauren. I'm going to be there, Lauren. A few other people might be popping in and out throughout the show. And we're going to have another one of our Christmas roundtable shows where we discuss, you know, holiday traditions and, you know, happy stuff. My mother will get more drink recipes because you remember that, Kurt talking about those slushies? Now my mother drinks those slushies all the time. Bad influence. Yes. But, see that? I'm yawning, Lauren.
Should we move on to our day in history then?
No, not yet, because I want to talk before we do that, that tonight's guest is some, I'm so excited for tonight's show. Because, and I'm sad Lauren's not going to be there for the interview because it's another one of those ones that's going to be recorded at like 3 a.m. her time.
He does this on purpose, listeners. He very much does this on purpose.
No, because this one would have been so good for Lauren, too, because we've got Dr. Justin Sledge, PhD, philosopher, just an expert of, you know, esotericism and hermetic knowledge and... you know, all the, what would you call it? The, to quote Manly P. Hall, the secret teachings of all ages, where, you know, he takes an academic, scholarly look at all these ancient rituals and wisdoms and legends and lore. And I just learned recently his particular field of expertise, his, like, the one he focused on for his PhD was esotericism in medieval times, Lauren. So that'd have been right up your alley, too.
Yes, it was, because you do have a lot of esoteric writers, and you do have more so than today, you do have mystic writers. Some of them are wild and crazy, and they do make for very uncomfortable reading. I mean, there was one mystic who the majority of them were nuns, apart from Marjorie Kemp and I think a few others. And she was volunteering at a leper hospital because nuns, like monks, provided the medical care. And she was caring for a leper, and then she drank the water after she washed them and made some comparisons to the Eucharist. And it was just sitting there going, trying not to vomit.
That's a lovely story right before I have my dinner, Lauren. Thanks so much on that note.
Well, I'm just sharing the love, because I had to read that and sit there and go, did you really just say that? And I had to double check, because obviously it was in Middle English. So I went back and I was like, yeah, that's exactly what she's saying. Oh, dear Lord.
Yep, that's precisely what she said.
But it's very interesting, because a lot of them, they wouldn't necessarily, female literacy wasn't always, you couldn't always assume female literacy, so that was always patchy. But a lot of them would have to, if they had a dream or a vision, would then go to their spiritual director, which was a man, and then they would say these stories, their visions, their dreams, their conversations to their spiritual director, who would then interpret that vision for them. So they were never allowed, they were never given the agency to sort of interpret it for themselves. They always had to have a medium to sort of sort that out for them.
Yeah, and tonight's episode, folks, just for those listening, you know, we may have a lot of laughs and fun in the first part of the show, but you know, we're going to be delving into some pretty heavy topics with Dr. Sledge tonight. Like I said, mysticism, esotericism, hermetic studies, ancient wisdoms and philosophies. So, you know, it can be pretty heavy stuff. So, you know, prepare yourselves.
I think if you are inspired to learn more after tonight's interview, of course, I've not listened to it and I won't listen to it until it airs. I do recommend that you start with Julian of Norwich. She's very lovely, and she speaks about, she's the first person ever to speak about the idea and the concept of divine unconditional love. And because of that, a lot of her work ended up as being heretical. And because of its status as heretical, then that's how it survived, which is a very weird story, because you think that things that were against the thinking of the church would be destroyed, but people like Thomas More collected heretical texts.
Yeah, and another great place is, I will pump it throughout the show and it'll be in the description, but Dr. Sledge's YouTube channel, where he does it's Esoterica is the channel, where he breaks down so many different philosophers, writers, the history of ancient texts, the Kabbalah, pretty much anything in mysticism and in ancient teachings. So it's going to be fun stuff, but we're going to have fun stuff too, Lauren. So clear your throat and give me a good day in history.
Today in history.
That was decent. All right, what you got for me, Lauren?
So considering it's coming up to Christmas, and considering it's probably the last time I could talk about the big man himself, Henry VIII, I noticed today, the 17th of December, 1538, is when Paul II, so Pope Paul II, excommunicated him. So it did take a while after the Reformation began to sort of like get him excommunicated.
Yeah, to say, hey, Henry, get the fuck out. And Henry was like, I don't give a shit. I'm starting my own religion.
Well, no, he didn't start his own religion. He started his own denomination of Christianity.
Well, yeah, if you want to be technical. He's basically, we're doing Catholicism with divorce, he said.
Well, you could get divorced in the Catholic Church, but you had to have a dispensation from the Pope, and you had to prove that your marriage, there is some sort of issue in your marriage that would prove that meant that you could question it legally or that it was not valid in the eyes of God.
And exactly, Lauren, how many common people could get the dispensation of the Pope?
Yeah, but then but it was different for a common person. I mean, the majority of common people would live together and the woman would be pregnant before the marriage just to prove that she was fertile.
Bow, wow.
That's the thing is, you have two different types. Back in the 16th century, you had two different types of engagements. You had, I am going to marry you, and the more formal and the one where you were able to consummate, which is, I will marry you. So I am and I will. So I will.
That's the audience applauding for the chicks that put out before marriage.
But technically, they'd have had their relationship blessed and there would have been some formal agreement which would have bound the two people together, meaning that before they solemnized it, they were able to have a physical relationship. There were lots of different rules. And for example, you could get a woman became an adult as soon as she on the occasion of her first menstruation. And then for a man, it was 15. So it was like 13 for a girl, 15 for a boy.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily, at that point, you could get married, but you wouldn't necessarily live together until you were a little bit older. So yeah. Marriage was very complicated. And, you know, there were all these rules in place.
It's still pretty complicated.
Yes.
So you want to hear my day in history, because it's not nearly as complicated as marriage or fucking.
Well, no, mine isn't. Mine is today in history. We officially broke away from Rome.
No, Rome officially broke away from you.
We don't like to see it. Like recollections may vary, Brian.
Well, just saying.
Recollections may vary. And we say we made the commitment first to break away from Rome.
Oh,
we
okay.
Said, no more Rome. We don't want you. You're taking all our money. We want to keep it. We want to pull down the monasteries and go to war. And yeah. So,
and I want to divorce my wives and behead them. So.
Well, actually, he could very much do nothing about Anne Boleyn. She was found guilty by a jury of her peers. As awful as that sounds and as controversial as that sounds, she was found guilty by a jury of her peers, which was the House of Lords, for acting on behalf of the king. And the second one, well, act of attainder. And if I had access to the act of attainder and somebody annoyed me, I would do the same.
Probably.
Probably.
Well, my day in history is much more lighthearted than that, Lauren. Because today in history, December 17th, 1936, was the first television appearance of the great ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy appeared on TV for the first time in 1936. Do you know Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy were big, huge radio stars, Lauren? A ventriloquist act that was a radio star. Think
well,
about
that's
that.
Easy way of doing, ventriloquism.
Think about it, Lauren. People tuned into the radio to hear a ventriloquist.
I know.
We were a lot more trusting of a country then, weren't we?
Yes.
In America. Now, you can't even tell people what they're seeing with their own eyes is real, because half the people will say it's absolutely bullshit or it's fake news. In 1936, the country tuned into a fucking ventriloquist on the radio.
Well, I think we tune into a lot worse now on the television.
Yeah, we do. But we're not going to be tuning into something bad tonight, because tonight's show is going to be excellent.
It will.
But and we're like, oh, my God, we're well more than 30 minutes into the rambling. So we better, you know, we better fire up. I'm looking all over for the magic interview box. Lauren, did you steal the magic interview box?
No, I did not.
I think you did. Why don't you turn the magic interview box on?
It's the magic interview box.
See, I knew you stole it, Lauren. All right. Just for that, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to flip the switch, and when we come back, we'll be on with Dr. Justin Sledge of Esoterica. And, Lauren, you won't be here, but you will next week. So, you know what? I'll be nice, Lauren. Since you're not here for the interview, you can flip the switch. All right. This is going to be such a great show, because I am thrilled and I am beyond excited to have someone whose work I really admire coming on the show. So listen, folks. It's going to be another Brian Geek Out episode, so I hope you don't mind, but hey, what are you going to do? It's my show, so I can geek out if I want. I have Dr. Justin Sledge of probably the greatest YouTube channel in the history of the existence of YouTube, Esoterica, but he is also a doctor, folks. I said doctor, you know, that's like PhD isn't like smarter than like most of us, and he is dedicated his life to the academic studies of mysticism and Gnosticism and occultism, and you name it, he does it, and he's the best, and you are going to love him. I'm sure a lot of you listen to his channel. If you haven't, you better start now, but let me welcome it on. Dr. Sledge, thank you for coming on Transatlantic History Ramblings.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and such kind words. Thank you.
So I got to go back to see, I did a little research on you when you actually agreed to come on after I stopped doing the happy dance. And I learned that you're from Mississippi.
That's right. Yeah, I was born and raised in South Jackson, Mississippi.
What is a good boy from Mississippi doing with all these dark occult studies? How do you get into this growing up in Jackson, Mississippi?
So Mississippi and the South in general has its own sort of occult heritage, right? This is also the same state where Robert Johnson famously sold his soul to the devil to learn to play the blues, and we're just up the road from New Orleans. And so as much as it is the buckle of the Bible Belt, it's also very much a place steeped in occultism. It, you know, these places tend to breed extremes. And so I think that may be part of the story, but at least the way that I got into this material was I just grew up watching a ton of shows like Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World and Leonard Nimoy on In Search Of, and any kind of documentary on, you know, aliens or ghosts or, you know, demons and the Bermuda Triangle or whatever. And I just fell in love with that kind of stuff. And I think that through life, people ultimately end up sort of going two ways about that kind of material. I think everyone's interested in it, especially as kids. But either you end up kind of going whole hog and, you know, being a believer in some of it or all of it, or you become a skeptic and you just basically lose interest in that kind of material altogether. I kind of did both. I kept the interest, but I became a skeptic too. And that ultimately led me to, you know, sort of through many winds and turns, as you can imagine, it ultimately led me to the University of Amsterdam, which is the only, at that time and still to a significant degree today, it's the only degree-granting institution in the world where you can get an advanced degree in Hermetic studies. So, it was started off with whatever eighth grade, fourth grade me being sitting in the library reading books about vampires in Atlantis, and ultimately now it's resulted in me becoming spending my life in developing an expertise around Western esotericism.
It's really amazing that, you know, I'm a New Yorker, born and raised Western New York, not New York City. And it's the exact same thing. I grew up loving, especially the shows you missed, Arthur C. Clarke's, especially In Search Of. I'm not sure how old you are. If you don't mind it, I'm 49. I'm assuming you're a few years younger than me, since you look quite a few years younger.
Yeah, I'm 41, 42. Born in 81, whatever that is, 41, 42. Born in 81.
So it's not that far off, really, of what we were watching, what we were brought up on. And I, much like you, developed into a skeptic, but a lover of all these things. I never lost my interest in them. In fact, on this show, we've had people on from all different forms of, from theoretical physicists to, you know, theosophers. We've also had on, you know, Bigfoot experts and UFO researchers, because I take a skeptical approach to everything, but I still love and admire all this, which is what I love about your channel in particular, is so many people who have an interest in, for lack of a better word, the strange, the weird, the wild. It's because they're so steeped in it, that's their practice. Whereas you are one of the few out there that it's a scholarly look at these things. You're not coming at it as a practitioner, but as an academic. And it's amazing. That's what makes your channel stand out. That and the fact that, you know, we're both sporting some pretty cool beards.
So yeah, the beard helps.
The beard helps. We both got that going.
Right. Yeah, it's the obligatory strange guy with a strange book's beard. It's a look. But yeah, I come at this material from an academic lens, but I also work hard to make sure that I'm being sympathetic to the text I'm or to the traditions and texts I'm representing. But also, I have practitioners on because I do think that the practitioner point of view is an important point of view. Now, I lead, of course, with an academic point of view, because that's how I'm trained. And that's what I think is really important, that even if you are a practitioner, you kind of need to know what the facts and the history are. And then, you know, you go out and make your way in terms of how you practice magic or what have you. But no, I try to have what I call critical skepticism, or sympathetic skepticism, which is I want to be deeply sympathetic to this material. And at the same time, hold it with some degree of skepticism and never let either of those go. I want to be as sympathetic as possible, and I want to be as skeptical as possible. And I think that that is a balance that one can strike. I don't know how often and how well I strike it, but I do aim for that.
Yeah, I call it open-minded skepticism, which is what I tell people, whether they're academics or believers or whatever, practitioners who come on my show. I'm like, look, I'm an open-minded skeptic. I'm not here just to be a yes man, but I'm open-minded about everything. And you know, I found that you actually get respect from both sides that way. I've been asked to write the foreword for a couple books by paranormal people, knowing that I'm a skeptic and a non-believer, that, you know, will you write the foreword? Okay, I'll do it, because I'm honest about it. You, on the other hand, went well beyond the love and passion I had for it and made it your life's work and your life's study. At what point, I'm not trying to like say, when did you become a bookworm nerd? I'm trying to say, at what point did it go from, you know, reading the Time Life mystery books, which are so much fun, turn into, wow, I want to start studying Rosicrucianism and Hermetic philosophy and true mysticism and ancient rituals. And what was that turning point? Was there a moment or a text you came across, or I don't know, something that maybe, you know, triggered that light in you?
I think that somewhere early on in maybe high school, late middle school, I got really interested in John Dee and Enochiana in general, Enochian magic, and the whole business of him and Edward Kelly talking to spirits. And those those diaries, the spirit diaries of Dr. John Dee, really fired my imagination. It was, you know, so strange, to say the very least. And I think that there were parts of those that I didn't feel like I had a good explanation for. You know, it sort of left the door open to the possibility that they were talking to something that was beyond human intelligence. And this is also when I was learning Latin, and, you know, the Enochian language is also the angelic language. The so-called celestial speech features pretty prominently into all that. And so there was a moment studying that material where there was a, I don't know what the right word is, like, you need to get to the bottom of this. Like, it's not as easy as just believing they are talking to angels, and nor is it going to be just as easy as to say, oh, he was just conned. This is just a con man, the con job in the 16th century. And even through high school, I continued to work at that. I wrote and rewrote a couple of John D. papers in high school for English classes and things like that. And then as I got into undergraduate, it became increasingly clear to me that the religious studies department and the philosophy department, I was double majoring in philosophy and religious studies, that, and this is no criticism of them, and I think that they did admit it, and they would now, is that this material goes woefully underappreciated in the academy and in history in general. It's been actively suppressed and repressed as part of sort of a irrational nonsense in Western history. And it became increasingly clear to me as I studied the material that this was a gap in the way the academy presented intellectual and spiritual history, the intellectual spiritual history of the West. And I kind of took it upon myself to be like, okay, my job, I want to fill that gap. I want to be the guy in the department where, you know, you have your classics guy, you have your modern philosophy guy, and you have me, who's the weirdo, you know, hiding out with all the Enochian books of magic, saying, hey guys, like, there's a whole other subterranean aspect of spirituality, of philosophy, of religion that's incredibly important and has played a decisive role in the history and development of Western thought and spirituality. And to leave it out is simply to do disservice to our task in the academy. And our task in the academy is to give a full as possible picture of that development. And this was a pretty serious gap, in my opinion. And so about halfway through undergraduate, I decided, you know what, I'm going to go to this program in Amsterdam and I'm going to get this education and I'm going to come back and I'm going to be the, you know, the hermetic studies guy in some department somewhere. That didn't work out. Well, I got the degree, but the becoming in some department didn't work out. We could talk more about that and how that went down. But yeah, at some level, that was sort of somewhere high school to undergraduate. It became clear, okay, this is what you need to do. This is where the work is, and this is where you need to go do the work.
And it's interesting you point out that there's such a gap, and I hate to paint things with a broad stroke, but I mean, you know, we got about an hour here to talk, so we're not going to be able to deep dive as much as we'd like. But it seems like, especially in Western society, Western religions, starting with, you know, the 15th century, you know, the church really started dictating, we don't want anybody knowing this. And it kind of suppressed it and frightened the public into it, which is why to this day, if someone finds out you're into mysticism, you're into occultism, you're into any of this, you're deemed evil. You know, people think you're demonic, you're a devil worshiper. I mean, one of the things that drew me to your channel was the video you did on the Satanic Panic, which I grew up knee deep in, and you unfortunately got more involved with it than I even did. But that gap, and it's still not there, which is sad that, like you said, you didn't become a head of a department teaching this. But do you think that gap will ever be filled? Or do you think Western society has been too strong with the power of the churches? Even though people can say they're running away from the church more and more each year, they still have enough power to control that gap. They keep it suppressed.
I think it's less the church these days and really hasn't been for a couple hundred years.
Yeah.
I would say the Enlightenment has just as much to do with the suppression of this material than the church did. Maybe the Enlightenment was even better at it at some level. Yeah, there's another argument he made that I would say the Enlightenment had more to do with the suppression of this material than the church did. Do I think it's going to become normalized? Not anytime soon. I'll speak for the United States and Canada. This is true for Canada as well. It's less true for Europe. Religious studies departments and philosophy departments are being shuttered all over the country. They're being underfunded and they're being gutted systematically. And if you, let's say you do have a religious studies department at your local university, which the university I teach at, Wayne State, does not have a religious studies department. That is shocking considering it is the largest urban university in the Detroit area, and we are one of the most religiously diverse areas in the Midwest. There is no religious studies department at all. So if there's no religious studies department at all, there's not going to be a job for me, basically. And that goes also with philosophy departments. Philosophy departments are shrinking at a rapid rate. Critical thinking is just something that Americans just don't have much of a stomach for whatever reason. And so if you can get a, let's say you can get a philosophy department off the ground, you're going to need a classics person, a modern person. You're going to need a medievalist. Maybe you're going to need some epistemology people, metaphysics people, ethics people. By the time you fill that department out with five or six positions, where is going to be the esotericism guy, and where is the money going to come from to hire him or her or they? And the answer is nowhere, because it's not a priority. And so now, one of the things that I've shown, I think, by starting the channel Esoterica, is that there is a deep, deep, very strong desire on the part of the public to have reliable scholarly access to this material. And this is sort of the weird catch-22. Esoterica, which has now over 500,000 subscribers, shows that there's a huge amount of interest in this material and a huge desire to have access to it using the tools of the Academy. But if you ask the Academy, do they want to hire someone like me to teach this material, they'll tell you there's no interest.
Of course not.
It's bizarre. It's like living in bizarro land, where I'm like, okay, I don't know what you're talking about, but there's a 500,000 people that clicked a button to subscribe to a channel to watch this material, and you're telling me there's no interest in this material. One of these stories is not true.
Yeah, especially when you're not the typical YouTuber who's doing clickbaity things and wild things and wacky things for views. You are doing a scholarly overview of this material, which is very in-depth, which, you know, for 500,000 people to be subscribed to something that is going to go over 90% of the population's head just on the base level of it shows there's a wide interest. And think about the people that – how many people are looking for esotericism on YouTube?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that shows you that the interest is even broader than they realize. If you go into an academic level, it's going to be even greater.
Yeah, That's my guess. But again, the Academy is a conservative animal. And so if I could just convince them to start a religious studies department, that would be a huge success. But even touching that in the United States is a third rail, because religion's a third rail issue. And so many departments are very slow to start a religion program whatsoever, which is, again, there's something deeply troubling about this to me, because religious illiteracy is a huge problem in our country, and religion is a huge issue in our country. We're a deeply religious country. And if you have a country that is, its population is deeply embedded in religion, and yet you facilitate religious illiteracy by not actually having academic programs to systematically and scientifically study religion, I mean, what are you doing to that dimension of your democracy? And it's quite a bad situation in my mind.
It's not just on an academic level in the United States, though. Religious illiteracy is a big factor with large groups of the religious population. So many people that are fundamentally religious in this country really know nothing about their own religion, which is why it's so easy to as they say, school them. But it doesn't really work that way, because they don't believe you anyway. But if you point out to them the hypocrisy of what they're saying, or your book doesn't say that, your Messiah never said this, they don't believe you, because they are kept religiously illiterate by those factions. They want their followers to be religiously illiterate. I do know why. I don't want to say I don't know why, because you and I both know why. It's easier to control. But on a scholarly level, the sad thing is that some of the schools that do have religious study courses happen to be religious schools that do a terrible disservice of religious studies, because they're trying to suppress.
Sure.
Do you think taking something like Esoterica, possibly to another type of platform where you can actually reach out, not like an online degree type of thing, but more of an educational resource. Do you think that's something that is doable? Maybe not for yourself, but for a group of people.
I think that we are living in a period where it's a bit of the Wild West when it comes to online independent educational entrepreneurs. And there's a lot of us, because the academic world doesn't really want us. And so we have to find a way to do what we love. And what we love is to facilitate education for people. And insofar as that's my life calling, and it is very much my vocation, you know, what I want to do with the rest of my life is provide education for people. I'm going to find whatever means that I can to do that, to make education as accessible as possible. And yeah, I'd love to expand as a Terica, as a platform, more broadly. That would include in-person learning, but also other modalities online. But I think we're still all figuring it out. I think we're all kind of throwing pasta at the wall. But what we're passionate about, and what we all share in common, and what I certainly want to do, is empower people to learn this material in a way that is rigorous, that obeys the best and highest scholarly standards, and also empowers them to continue doing the education for themselves on their own. And that's why, if you watch an episode of Esoterica, basically what I do at the end of every episode is say, like, look, it's sort of like my, Reading Rainbow moment, right? But don't take my word for it. Here's a boatload of expensive academic books you can buy to deepen your knowledge of this material, because I do think that people ultimately are going to be their best own teachers. But I don't know what the future holds for what education on this platform will look like, but I do know that as the Academy continues to kind of throw us under the bus, we're not going to let them kill our passions, and we're just going to find new ways of keeping those passions alive. And I think that's going to mean increasingly going to independent presentation of the information, which also means a lot of people don't have to go thousands of dollars in debt and student loans to get access to it.
That's true. Just tens of dollars in debt to watch them online. That'd be great.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, for me, one of the things that triggered my advanced interest in it, like I said, having a base interest from the same background as you, the television shows, the Time Life books, all that, was when I started discovering people like, Manly P. Hall, Secret Teachings of All Ages, which, was just kind of gave you a little breadcrumbs into everything, and it set you on a path. Now, those societies, the Theosophy Society, still has quite a large following. Manly's one in California, which I can't believe I just forgot the name of it. I've even had the curator on the show, and it's going to drive me nuts now, but that's okay. They still have several thousands of members that will go on to study. I mean, do you think there's something with you and some of the other scholars that you associate with or that you work with to set up something like them? It's an option. I mean, and it's something that people would. It's kind of like, the if you build it, they will come kind of thing, if we're going to go baseball analogy.
Yeah, it's possible. The problem is that a lot of those early 20th century movements, like the Theosophical Society and the group of folks around Manly P. Hall, back when the Freemasons were a big deal, and the Odd Men, a lot of these orders that existed, even the Golden Dawn and stuff like that. Well, they only got founded because pretty wealthy individuals in them dumped a bunch of money into getting them going. And it frankly was much cheaper to do that back then than it is now. I mean, go look up rents in New York or New Orleans or Austin and look at rents for a building. And, as soon as you begin to do the math of how do you get a building, how do you hire staff, how do you get janitorial services, how do you get books, all of a sudden the only way to make that work is to pass that number on to the people that would sign up. And then you've recreated the problem. So I think we're going to have to think through some new creative modalities by which to provide the same education and at the same time not straddle people with a bunch of debt or not put people in a situation where they have to travel halfway across the world like I had to. I had to move to Amsterdam. I think that people deserve access to this information in a variety of means, in a variety of depths, in a variety of modalities that make the most sense to them. And I think it's going to be up to people like me and other scholars that I work with to figure out what those modalities look like. But the good news is that we all know each other. We're all friends. We're all colleagues. We're working together. And these are conversations we're actively having. And I think that it is possible that I don't think we're going to go the direction of degree granting institution or something like that. But I do think that One, we could pair up with already existing institutions and work with them to provide our services. We could do those services online. I think there's a lot of ways of doing this, but I think what's important to me is putting the education front and foremost, and putting that education front and foremost with as little strings attached as possible, especially financial strings, because I'm straddled with a bunch of student debt. I mean, it's just a reality, fact of life what I had to do to get the degree I have. I don't think people should have to spend $40,000 to learn what I learned. And I want to make sure that I'm doing my part to make sure that doesn't happen to someone else.
And one thing that good that came out of the pandemic was that we learned that you can educate via the internet now. Skype, which we're using now, or Zoom, can be used to do all these things. It's not, we're not living in the world we were 30 years ago. Technological advances, modern technology makes ancient wisdom more accessible. Isn't that wonderful?
It does. It really does. And it also, you know, even getting access to, you know, I'm also a lot of times when I have to work on projects for Esoterica, you know, the books I have to work with aren't in modern editions. You know, this is an example of a book of Hermetic medicine. This has no modern edition. It was never reprinted after it was printed this time. This is the Pharmacopoeia Dogmatorum. You can see it's the book of Hermetic medicine. This was published in 1607. There's no modern edition of this book. If I want a copy of it, this is it. And this is a copy from 1607. And what's great about this and modern technology is I can also finally now get this digitized and work with it remotely if I need to and things like that. So, yeah, I think that technology is going to facilitate the solution to a lot of these problems, but in itself is not a solution.
I so wish my co-host could have been here right now. Lauren, my co-host, who's in Swansea, Wales, her master's degree was in medieval studies and medieval prisons. So she spent a good part of her education in Wales translating 16th century books from, you know, Old English or Welsh or Latin into, you know. So you and her could have a nice group hug over that, about the difficulty of that. But I'm glad you brought up books, because that's something I wanted to go into with you. You are the book king of all these texts. How the hell did you track down so many of these vintage ancient texts? I mean, did you have a horseshoe that I don't see behind your beard?
I wish I did. Some magic book attracting thing. Yeah, speaking of books, you know, I have this just sitting here working on this the other day. This is the complete works of Paracelsus. It's a massive, massive tome here in Latin. It's
actually three volumes. On your Q&A, your live Q&A, I snuck into your live Q&A while I was at work and saw that. And I was like, where does he get these things?
Where did he get these wonderful toys?
Yes, thank you, the Joker.
It's a good question. The rare book world, the antiquarian book world, is a strange world. The antiquarian occult book world is an even stranger world, as you can imagine. And it has everything to do with knowing what you're looking for. And often what ends up happening is people have a vague idea about occult books, especially sort of early modern and medieval occult books. And they sort of vaguely know there are books out there about alchemy. But most people don't drill down further than there are books on alchemy, or the top 10 most famous books of alchemy, the Theatrum Chemicum Britannicum or Basil Valentine's. And so what you have to do is really familiarize yourself with the field. And one of the ways that I do that is through catalogs. And so, for instance, you can buy, I have it sitting over there, the catalog of every single occult book that Yale has. And the Yale went through, they cataloged their entire catalog in the 19th century and again in the early 20th century. And they categorize things and they're like, okay, we need to put out an entire catalog of all the alchemy and occult books we have. And I've read through that entire catalog probably 5 times. It's 3 thick volumes. And you begin looking through them and going, oh yeah, so this is a book about Hermetic medicine that, like, it's a Paracelsian text of Hermetic medicine. What is that exactly? What's in that book? And then I go start pecking and hunting for it. And I ultimately will find it in one random collection. That book, for instance, was in a random collection of an Austrian book dealer who primarily deals in medical and antiquarian books. And he just so happened to have it because it was for him, he just thought of it as a medical textbook. But of course, it's a very peculiar kind of medical textbook. And what's lucky about that for me is that it's so peculiar, no one else wanted it because, you know, it's this bizarre hermetic medicine that ultimately did not make its way into modernity. But of course, that's grist for my meal. And so I picked it up. So yeah, what I do is I snoop around rare bookstores, rare book markets, estate sales. Anytime a doctor dies in Europe and they have a book collection, you best believe I'm sniffing through that catalog looking for instance, a psychiatrist famously, recently a psychiatrist died and his entire collection went to auction. And that Paracelsus volume was in his collection because Paracelsus writes some of the earliest books on diagnosing psychiatric conditions and also treating psychiatric conditions using medicine, using Paracelsian medicine. And that's a huge leap forward in terms of basically what we now think of as psychiatry. The use of pharmacological tools to treat mental illness was developed primarily by Paracelsus, and that's why he had the complete works.
So you use your powers as a ghoul for good.
Yes, I snoop around the recently deceased, looking for strange and unusual books that they had. That's one of the things I do. You know, some of it's just jumping onto rare book search engines when I see a book I'm curious about. And another great resource is this. I think I showed this also in a live stream. This is the Index Prohibitorum. This is the list of banned books that the Catholic Church should not want anyone reading. At least the Catholic Church didn't want anyone reading them when this edition came out. And I can just start flipping through this Index Prohibitorum. This was put out in the mid 18th century, I think. And basically, I can put my finger anywhere in this book and be like, "What's that book?" If it was interesting enough to get banned by the church, then it's interesting enough for me to go hunt down and at least get a look at what it is in terms of the catalog description or something. So yeah, I think I have at this point a pretty extensive collection of 17th and 18th century occult books, mostly because I need them to do my research, because they just frankly, you can't get them at Amazon. That's just not going to happen.
Isn't it sad? We need an Amazon esoterica. We need a hermetic Amazon. We need Gnosticism.
I'll get on that. But I do, you know, anytime I do cover a really obscure book and I can find a digitized copy of, which isn't always the case, actually. But when I do find a digitized copy of it somewhere, Google Books has done a pretty good job of this. The Vatican has done an amazing job of this, frankly. People often think of the Vatican as being very inaccessible, but that's actually not true. I've been there. And anytime I can link someone to a digital volume of one of these books, and I always do, because I think people should get access to them. But of course, that assumes that you read Latin and those kinds of skill sets that are basically just fundamental to this field. You have to be able to read Latin. You have to have some Hebrew. You have to have some Greek. You know. And that's why getting into this field can be so challenging, because most people don't have the kind of background skill set that's typically required to get into this. You know, if there's no modern edition of this book of hermetic medicine, I can guarantee you there is no translation into English.
Not yet.
I'm definitely not doing it.
I'm looking at you. I'm just saying.
I you know, it's funny because I've done some translation work in the past. I don't want to do it, but I yeah, just this last year on the channel, there was there's a great medieval book of necromancy, CLM 849, the Munich Necromancer's Manual, and it's big chunks of it are translated to English, but not all of it. And there's a spell in there for a myth, a mirror of Lilith, which I think is actually a spelling error. I don't think it's about Lilith at all. I think it's about another demon named Bilith. But I realized there was no translation of it, and everyone loves Lilith. She's just everyone loves Lilith these days. And I did translate it for that, I think for one of the first times into English, and that was kind of fun.
Did you say, "Sorry, folks, it's not Lilith"?
I did, and some people got kind of sad. They're like, and I gave reasons why I think that it's not really about Lilith, but I think it's about another demon. But it's still about a demon. It's a demon mirror.
Yeah, come on, folks, it's a demon. Let it go, right?
Yeah, like come on, like it's a demon mirror. Be happy it's a demon mirror. But But yeah, so those are cases where if I'm already spot translating and I'm making notes as I go, then of course I'll release that stuff into the wild. But the idea of sitting down and what this or Book of Hermetic Medicine is, has to be, yeah, it's over 600 pages long, and it's just chock full of these hermetic potions, these like instructions basically to make all these medicines, and they contain all kinds of stuff. Some of it definitely poisonous,
but it could be a great drinking game for the channel.
It could be, yeah, and maybe there's some good cocktails in here. In fact, there's one for that calls for salt of absinthe. So this one contains absinthe. I've definitely seen some of these other ones contain. This one contains cinnamon, which is not mace. Some of them contain other not so fun things like belladonna and henbane. So I imagine if you're drinking a hermetic medicine contains enough alcohol, absinthe, henbane, and belladonna, you're gonna have a hell of a night. Something.
Craziest night of my life in Paris I ever had was with a bottle of absinthe and a bunch of other things mixed up.
Yeah, I mean, hope you have good health insurance.
It was bad. I was much younger then. I could, you know, not a good night. I have to say this. I mean, you're a family man. You have children. You have a life partner. Do you read stories of demons to your kids to sleep?
No, I did, however, buy them the kiddo version of Night of the Living Dead. There's like a kid version of Night of the Living Dead. And I do. And we have Goodnight Cthulhu and the ABCs of H.P. Lovecraft. And so they do know who Cthulhu is and so stuff like that. So they do have a little, you know, and they're little, they're only 3 and 5. So, but if you were to ask my kids who Cthulhu is, they could tell you. So yeah, we give them a little taste of cosmic horror. And
do they cheer for Cthulhu?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because the book ends with like, you got to go to sleep, Cthulhu, tomorrow's full of adventures. And I'm like, yeah, it sure is, for Cthulhu's he's gonna rise and kill us all. And you know, I say that kind of stuff under my breath, and my partner's like, don't say that. But yeah, I have the Night of the Living Dead book for them, so they know what zombies are. Yeah, we have conversations about what ghosts are and stuff like that. And they also know that Abba, as they say, Abba, you know, I'm Jewish, and so they say Abba has spooky books. So it's funny, like, oh, that's, and they know, they've seen enough antiquarian books that they know, like, oh, that's an Abba book, and that's an Abba spooky book. And the Abba spooky books are all the old books. Some of them are not spooky, like some of them are just Thomas Aquinas's, you know, Summa Theologica, which I guess can be spooky depending on how much damage the Catholic Church has done to you. But yeah. So even my kids can be like, oh, that's an Abba spooky book.
You just mentioned you were Jewish. I didn't want to actually go to any personal beliefs, but you said it. You are practicing, correct?
Yeah, my wife is a rabbi. Yeah,
I know that.
Yeah, my wife is a rabbi. I would consider myself a religious person. Yeah.
Which to me is fascinating. I myself am very open on the channel often that I'm an atheist. I hold no views. I don't discourage anybody from belief either way. Lauren, my co-host, is a devout Christian. Do you get pushback from the religious community just for even possessing these texts, or because, you know, I come from a religious town, fundamentally Christian town, and growing up, like I said, during the Satanic Panic, being, you know, the weirdo who read the books on the occult and was not a believer, they didn't see me in church, they always assumed that I'm the devil worshiper. Do you get that kind of pushback from not even people you know, but just the outside world who says, you study this so you're evil, you possess these books so your house is possessed? Do you have to deal with that?
I guess I can sort of fan out. So from my own community, definitely not. They're just like, yeah, that's Justin, that's what he does, he's just he studies his stuff, this is a job basically. And then sort of growing out of the larger Jewish community, Yeah, I think there's sort of a sense of like, oh yeah, he studies Kabbalah, and that's weird. That's like the weird part of Judaism. And there's, but also I get invited all the time to synagogues to talk about Jewish magic and Kabbalah. Judaism has always had a much more copacetic relationship to its occult side than Christianity has. Judaism has always seen it as kind of a spectrum, and it's a, you're kind of weird, but yeah, you're on the same team. So, and there's no devil character in Judaism so much, so you can't really be a devil worshiper. That whole system of belief just doesn't work in Judaism. But you know, in the wider community and the wider world, yeah, I have all kinds of people that I get comments all the time from fundamentalist people being like, yeah, you're going to go to hell because you're teaching people to worship the devil. And I'm like, I guess you have not actually watched my channel. That's definitely not what I'm doing. And yeah, I have gotten people who, you know, they claim to be clairvoyant or claim to be, have some kind of extrasensory perception or some kind of other sense that I can't claim myself to have. And, you know, they say, yeah, that they feel kind of weird mojo coming off of some of these books. But I don't experience that, and I haven't experienced any sort of weird goings on in my house or whatever because of the presence of these books. But I'm also not a believer in the supernatural, and Judaism has branches of its belief that reject supernaturalism. So I'm also a non-theist and don't believe in the supernatural. Now, that doesn't mean it's not there. It very well could be where I could just be in the same way that a blind person saying that they don't believe in colors would strike us as a bit silly. It could just be the case that I'm tone deaf to the supernatural. That's certainly possible. But I'm also a disbeliever in the supernatural. And so I'm not when I'm sitting around reading a book of black magic or whatever. Frankly, that stuff comes across to me. I've read so much of that stuff, and I've handled these manuscripts, you know, that are allegedly cursed and pacts made with the devil. And I've handled so much of this material in libraries and in museums. It just kind of gets silly after a while. Like how many demons are you going to summon to find buried treasure or get a girlfriend or make dogs not bark at you or summon a banquet? Or when you actually get into these books, at least in my experience, the shock effect of making a deal with the devil, it gets pretty old pretty fast. It makes for good TV and it makes for good movies. But when, you know, the 80th time you've seen another spell for getting a demon to get you a girlfriend and find you buried treasure, I'm like, this is cute.
It is. It is. I have the same way when I read these things that I love the people, the most terrifying story of demons. Like they're almost comical to me. They're comic book like. You just,
yeah.
But you brought up something that I wasn't sure I was going to touch on, because I don't know. I don't even know if you'd have an opinion on this, but you, your channel, you discuss the Kabbalah or Kabbalah. I always pronounce it wrong. Being a Northern, you know, a New Yorker, it's so weird. These conspiracy theorist movements now, the QAnons of the world, that are so deeply rooted in extreme Christian fundamentalism, all of a sudden start using gematria and Kabbalah as proof of their beliefs. I mean, do you understand where this crossover is coming from, or how?
I think that it's old. You know, Christianity is always
same things that's been done before, but now they're targeting just the specific group of people and convincing them.
Yeah. It's always been the case that, I mean, conspiracy theory people and numbers have always had a unique dance they've done together. And this sort of like finding meaning in noise, basically, is just tantamount to how a lot of religion works, frankly, but also just how a lot of sort of esoteric meaning making goes. Because what ends up happening in a conspiracy theory thinking, but also in esoteric thinking, is that there's nothing without meaning. And typically the easiest way of extracting that meaning is by applying over it something that is has the veneer, at least, of logic. And that's going to be mathematics. And so you see this kind of thing happening all through history, whether it's the Bible being translated into numbers and being read through gematria, or through early Christians hiding criticisms of, for instance, Nero in the New Testament, the book of Revelation, and the number 666 or 616, depending on which manuscript you're reading. So I think it's just a way of making sense of the world, and mathematics, and at least a veneer of mathematics, really numerology more than mathematics, is a way of things being made to make sense in a way that looks logical. But of course, if you get into the weeds of it, it's not terribly logical.
Yeah, but what baffles me about this time is compared to others is you are having these, like I said, deeply devout fundamentalist Christian groups, the evangelical groups. I can't even call them devoutly Christian because they really don't know what's in their own text, like we agreed earlier, for the most part. But now they're actually using the words gematria and Kabbalah. They're acknowledging that it comes from a belief system outside of theirs, and they're using it. That to me is where it gets a little confusing today.
Well, it's baffling. This is a quite old phenomenon. It goes back to Pico della Mirandola. Pico, of course, famously employed what he called miraculous appropriation in the 15th century to extract truths, so-called truths, from the Kabbalah, basically forcing converted Jews to translate sections of the Kabbalah into Latin as basically a means by which he thought he could use to synthesize all religion and therefore convert the Jews to Christianity. And so sometimes it's referred to as using the dagger against the Jew, using the dagger of Judaism against the Jew, or
how
whatever.
How did that work out for him?
I mean, I think that it was in some sense quite successful. I mean, it did lead to the rise of Christian Kabbalah and ultimately to the rise of the occult. And so it was successful in terms of basically he and some of his friends basically founding an entire new religious movement in the Catholic core. I mean, he's doing this stuff right in Rome and in Florence. And so it's within that very Catholic core that this Christian Kabbalah emerges as a tool basically to synthesize Catholicism and early kind of, you know, or proto-Protestantism and Judaism, and eventually they thought Islam as well, into sort of a perennial religion and a perennial Christianity rather, and then basically usher in the apocalypse through that. And so this impulse, this very deeply apocalyptic, esoteric Christian impulse, goes back into the 15th century with people like Pico della Mirandola and Marsilio Ficino and some of their translators like Flavius Mithridates and Resius and people like this. So, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. This is a unique mutation of that, but it's a mutation of a well-established mental virus, one might say, that is actually quite old.
And the end results are the same for now as then. Well, what they want the end results to be are the same.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's a deeply apocalyptic view, and it's a view in which they're the unique ones who are right, and they're the chosen one who have the secret knowledge, and they can unveil the secret knowledge using these tools. If they only knew that they were doing a really old dance, I'm not sure they would still do it, but I'd probably be surprised.
No, they would still do it. They would.
The basic components of what make
a new dance to a new beat. It's a same old dance, but to a new beat. They're going to do it.
Yeah. And again, also, it's not just that stuff, but also it's community. A lot of these people are very lonely. They're connected through communities of things like QAnon. So it functions as a new kind of religious community. And I mean, again, we're living in one of the most connected periods in human history, which is also polling as one of the most lonely periods in human history. And so we should be unsurprised that apocalyptic desires for building community don't it's surprising to me they're not more prevalent.
Well, you know, it will once we all realize that we must bow down before Cthulhu.
Yes. Yeah. Right before he wipes us off the planet.
I mean, come on, folks, get with the program.
Yeah, yeah, I love. I think one of my favorite bumper stickers was a sort of bumper sticker of Cthulhu just destroying the planet, and it was like, you know, Cthulhu 2024 just ended already.
I have the shirt that I have that says, "Have you met my Lord and Savior Mothra?" So you know, Mothra will save us all.
Hey, pick your kaiju.
I just did. Hello. Yeah. Okay, now you got to pick yours. Come on.
Oh, I don't know. I'd pick some random Lovecraftian one, y'all, because I thought or something. I don't know. Whatever one is least pronounceable.
And that's another thing about this kind of study. I'm bringing, because of Lovecraft, you're a scholar. You don't have to agree with these things to like it. Lovecraft was a piece of shit, okay, yeah. As a person. His morals...
Yeah, he was a racist for sure.
He was a racist. He was a bigoted. He was an obnoxious human being, but that doesn't take away from how great his work is.
Sure. I don't get in the business of canceling history. I mean, I'm literally in the canceled history.
Yeah, I was going to say you can't. You are the canceled history.
Yeah, I am the canceled history. My job is the canceled history. I think that when we do history, we have to do it warts and all. And I study a bunch of unsavory people. I just mentioned Pico della Mirandola. I'm Jewish. He basically made a bunch of converted Jews, forced them to translate their own tradition to use it as a weapon against Jewish people. I'm not a big fan of that, as you can imagine. But me not being a fan of it doesn't mean it's not historically important. And frankly, if we want stuff like that not to happen in the future, we prevent that by studying it and understanding it really well. So, yeah, I tell people, yeah, I love to read Heidegger or whatever. Heidegger was a Nazi. So when the man's right, he's right. I'm not in the business of canceling my history or any history, because the moment we cancel history is the moment we stop learning from it. And I have zero interest in that as a that kind of anti-intellectualism is going to pay us very poor dividends.
I like to think that, especially in America, historically, the Jews have been the best with senses of humor and comedy writing. So I like to think, this is just my playful mind going, when those Jews were forced to translate, they were throwing in mistranslations and jokes just to fuck with them.
Oh, they definitely were. In fact, they actually were making things up. There are several places where they just straight up make up stuff. There's kind of a wink and a nod. That they're doing it. And, you know, Pico, he didn't know, he can't read Hebrew, so he couldn't really understand what's happening. And so, yeah, there's also some of these guys. Resius is a great example. Paul Resius, who translated Joseph Kikatia's Sha'ari Ora, The Gates of Light. He was a virulent anti-Semite, a converted Jew who became a very, very virulent anti-Semite. And it was only because of a German Gentile, Johannes Reuchlin, where Reuchlin went, who also an occultist, went right up against him and said, we're not burning books. We're not burning Jewish books. There's wisdom here. Like, yeah, I get it. You converted and you're all about the conversion life for great, but we're not burning any books. And Reuchlin was a fascinating occultist. He wrote two of the early fundamental books on Christian and occult Kabbalah, and also was a person who actively resisted very early German anti-Semitism. So this is a place where, again, you can look back in history and say, oh, these occultists, not only were they not devil worshippers or whatever, but they're in many ways incredibly progressive-minded people with a deep dedication to ecumenicalism and trying to find the truth wherever it is, even outside their own traditions. And there's something to be admired in that.
Yeah, but progressive-minded people are just as bad as devil worshippers, too.
Oh, they're all the same. They're all the...
So, you got to watch what you say there.
The devil worshippers and the commies, they're all...
They're one and the same.
When you really get down into the... you scratch any of these things, and you're like, oh, it's just the devil-worshipping Jewish commie lizard people.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they lump me in there, and I'm not a Jew, so, you know... Hey.
You come from New York.
I could be a lizard person. You never know. I have the hair and the beard.
You could be a lizard person. I've also been accused of being a lizard person, which I do love the emails I get when I'm accused of being part of the international Jewish conspiracy to make everyone be an occultist to serve the devil. I'm like, if I were part of a vast international conspiracy, I would love to get my check, because I am not getting a check for this.
And I don't think you'd be in Detroit. If you were part of that.
Yeah, no, I would. I'd be living in some castle in Austria or something. I don't know.
And no hate mail, folks. I'm not bashing Detroit. Everybody knows I'm a diehard Detroit Red Wings fan, even though I'm from Buffalo. I love Detroit. I love the city of Detroit. But
Detroit's a great city. It's a great, you know, again, it's a city with a lot of heart, and I love the people here. And yeah, you know, it's a place where I don't hear people complaining about things. It's a place where people look to find solutions rather than complaining.
And Windsor, Ontario, a hell of a town right across the border.
It's right across the border to the south of us. Us and Alaska share in common. We can go south to get to Canada.
To get to Canada. And see, I love the towns right over the border. Like I said, I live in Buffalo. Right over, I'm 10 minutes away from the border, too. Isn't it great being on the border? You didn't get that in Mississippi.
No. It's great in case I need to, you know, dash out. Go be a refugee. It's just right there if need be.
Okay, I was thinking in case you needed to get some good poutine, you're thinking fleeing the country. Okay, where are we? Who's part of
this? This is a very Jewish part of me. Yeah, you know, when you hear a loud enough boom outside, you look for your passport.
I just want the poutine.
Hey, that's also good. That's also good. But yeah, I love being in Detroit, and also Ann Arbor is there's a lot of the Theosophical Society was a really big deal here. You know, Detroit also has the largest Masonic temple in the world. So we have an enormous Masonic temple here that's beautiful, absolutely beautiful. And so there's a great occult history. You know, Aleister Crowley spent a decent amount of time here in Detroit. And a lot of the places where Crowley was sort of setting up shop with the OTO and stuff, they're still there. One of the Freemason lodges where he set up a early OTO thing is actually abandoned. And there's a part of me that just wants to like go buy it because I'm sure I could get it for relatively inexpensive, and that'd be the place to start the esoteric school is in.
You see
where Aleister Crowley used to haunt these walls.
Alistair's another one that I kind of get the giggles reading now because it's so over the top. And it's just a name that scares the shit out of so many people without knowing too much.
Yeah, but Crowley was a unique genius who also was a deeply troubled person and morally compromised in lots of ways. But again, a person whose moral and spiritual genius, whose moral depravity in some level and his opportunism, frankly, but also a spiritual genius in his own right. So I think he's one of these characters that, yes, we need to deal with them, warts and all, but I think we also need to take seriously some I think really, you know, his lectures on yoga, for instance, are one of the best introductions of yoga I think ever written. And
I think he was also playing to a crowd. I think he had a lot of winking and nods in his public
persona. Sure, yeah. Oh, absolutely. But yeah, if Aleister Crowley was good at anything, he was a showman and he was good at self-promotion. He was pretty good at mountaineering as well and chess. He's a character that I used to have a lot of disdain for, but mostly because I had a lot of disdain for young men who really aped being Aleister Crowley. And the only thing worse than Aleister Crowley is a 22-year-old man trying to be Aleister Crowley. Oh man. I always tell people, if you hear a young man talk about Aleister Crowley or Friedrich Nietzsche, run.
That's a good one. I'm going to write that down and I'm stealing that. And I'm saying it right here that I'm stealing it. So you could sue me if I do, because it's going to be, there's proof of it. You know, it's funny. The Masonic temple that was literally a block away from where I live right now is now apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wanted to move into it. I don't know why. Not a Mason, but I just love that.
I mean, I will say the Masons, for all the great things that they do, I mean, they do make beautiful buildings and they have to. It's kind of their shtick.
It's kind of in the name. Yeah.
And so, and again, to the point we were talking about earlier about how difficult it would be to make a modern sort of esoteric academy. As much as I would love to do that, you know, these are the days where the Masons are closing down their shops and turning them into apartments. That institutional brick and mortar type orders like that are quickly coming to an end. And the question is, you know, what's going to rise from the ashes of that? And something will. And
well, that's the brilliance of this time. You are in the perfect time and place to get on the ground floor of setting this up as a virtual institution. Brick and mortar is no longer needed.
Yeah, I totally agree. Or there's other institutions that are brick and mortar that I do want to work with. One is the Embassy of the Free Mind in Amsterdam. And that's an organization that I have a deep, deep love for. And we've done some preliminary work together already, and we're going to be doing some more, hopefully. And that's the kind of institution that they just got UNESCO recognition, which is I mean, can you imagine going from a library of basically banned books to being a UNESCO recognized institution? It's really a decisive moment in the history of Hermetic philosophy and the occult. And that also is going to mean money, and it's going to mean a lot of other things. But I think that also it could mean some kind of collaboration between myself and them as an institution, where both online and in person Hermetic education becomes possible, and it becomes possible through basically a UNESCO recognized institution. And I think that's that could be the beginnings of again, something like a new kind of academy of this material, not a Hogwarts, but something like maybe the best we can do in the meantime.
I don't feel bad. People have turned on her too, so I'm surprised those books aren't canceled yet, but they will be.
I think some people have already tried that. Yeah.
Yeah, they have. I know we're over the hour mark. I told you we wouldn't go over an hour, but I do want to ask one question. A, will you come back on? Because we barely scratched the surface of anything. Of course. I'd love to talk more. B, please allow me to follow you to wherever this virtual course goes, because, as I said, I'm a big fan, and I will always be there supporting and following what you do. The last question I have before I let you go, of all that you study and all that you do and all these videos you do, is there anything you still get a bang out of? That you do for fun, for pleasure, not for academic reasons, not for study, not because you have to, not because you need to, but because, damn, I still get a bang out of reading books on alchemy or whatever.
Yeah. The answer to your first question is yes, I would love to come back on. So just make whenever you want that to happen. The second question is, yeah, when and if there's a new development in how esoteric is going to function, yeah, I'll be making that very public. And I'd be happy to have anyone who wants to come along in this strange and unusual journey that is this project. And third, it is interesting. You hit the nail on the head. It is alchemy. You know, alchemy is my first esoteric love. I remember as a kid teaching myself how to roast cinnabar, reading alchemical manuscripts and reading them in Latin. I was learning Latin at the time, and I was using these. In fact, one of my my Latin teacher in high school let me translate an alchemical tract as an assignment. So I learned literally reading Latin, reading alchemy. And to this day, alchemy is still my first love. I still love, people may not know this, but about 90% of alchemical texts are not translated. There's no modern editions. The vast majority of alchemical literature remains in the dark. And yeah, there's a part of me, a big part of me, that if I really want to go to that place where I just feel like, this is why I love this, is, you know, I can pour a glass of rye whiskey and sit up late at night, or sit up in as the snow comes down, and crack open one of these volumes, these alchemical texts that I have, and just start reading it, and start reading it knowing that it's possible no one's looked at this in hundreds of years, and getting inside of the alchemical mind, the mind that's trying to desperately understand the fundamental hidden nature of reality. It's such a daring mind. It's such a curious mind that as I'm working through a text like that, it also allows my mind to kind of break out of the straitjacket that can be just mere academic and mere scholarship and mere logic. And it allows my mind to kind of soar a little bit above that, and also reach back to that deep old love of the kid me, and feel those kind of deep emotions of joy and mystery and some sense that the world is not the way that it appears, and really take a lot of glee, pleasure in the mystery. And I always feel deeply blessed and very lucky that I have the opportunity to do what I do. And in those moments, I can recapture that youthful feeling of mystery and the joy of peering into this otherwise very dark and hidden aspect of our history and of our culture and of our intellectual and spiritual development. And that's always feels just positively amazing for me.
Well, I know I speak for not only myself, but over 500,000 people that subscribe to the channel and so many more out there that will discover the channel, that I feel blessed and lucky that we have someone like you that takes us along on these journeys and will share this knowledge and will share this wisdom and hopefully preserve a lot of this knowledge for future generations. And, you know, there's a lot to be said. You do a lot for not only the field of study, but for the future. And we thank you so much for that. And Dr. Sledge, is there anything you want to promote before you take off? Or
no, I don't have a lot to promote. You know, I'm terrified of social media, so I don't have any social media aside from YouTube, which is how much more public could you be, I suppose. But yeah, I'm just on YouTube. And so if folks want to find me on YouTube, you can find my channel Esoterica. I also have a website. It's just justinsledge.com. And I do buy and sell a couple of esoteric occult antiquarian books there. But yeah, that's basically my footprint or whatever on the internet. So I'm not on Instagram or Twitch. I don't play video games. So I don't, maybe I could like get on Twitch or OnlyFans and just read alchemy books to people.
But you have to read on OnlyFans. You'd have to read it with just like strategically covering parts with the book. And that's creepy.
Yeah. I would just like, cover my beard.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, but no, the only place I live on the internet is just basically on YouTube, and folks can find me there. And that's where I produce basically weekly content on topics in esotericism.
And it is a channel you all need to subscribe. Check it out. It is fantastic. Dr. Sledge, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. I hope you'll be joining us again soon. And I guess for everybody out there, I'm going to say, since Lauren's not here in Swansea, this is Brian in Buffalo saying good night.
Well, no, I'm not supposed to make jokes. That's the problem. Me making jokes was the problem.